Welcome to another episode of Does Not Compute. Today, the show is brought to you by Hired. If you've ever looked for a design or dev job before, you probably know how stressful it can be. Things move super slowly, dealing with recruiters can be a nightmare, and it's pretty common to go through a long interview process just to find out at the end that the salary offer or company culture isn't a fit. Hired helps solve all those problems, which makes it a pleasure to find your next job. After you've signed up and set up your profile, employers will apply to you instead of the other way around. Over the course of 4 weeks, you'll get personalized interview requests that include salary and equity information up front to help you find a great fit. Hired has job opportunities from over 4,000 employers in 17 major cities across North America, Europe, Asia, and Australia. That means there's a really good chance they've got an awesome job waiting for you. Hired is completely free to use. They actually pay people who find a job through them $1,000 as a way to say thanks. Better yet, you can double that hiring bonus to $2,000 by signing up at hired.com/doesnotcompute. Our thanks to Hired, and remember to check them out today at hired.com/doesnotcompute.
I'm having trouble speaking, Paul, because there are a lot of things floating around in my brain right now.
Yeah, like programming things or just things?
Well, yeah, I have a number of things floating around in my brain, but this morning they're directly related to Mr. John Gold screwing my life up. He's always tweeting these links that I start to read, and they take me down into the rabbit hole.
I'm looking at our internal show notes here, and you've written a lot of math looking things.
Yeah. I don't remember exactly when. I think it was maybe earlier last week, Mr. Gold tweeted an ebook, and he said it was his favorite book on functional programming. And the title was Mostly Adequate Guide to Functional Programming. And instantly I was like, I'm gonna read that. I like that title. It's mostly adequate. It doesn't give me any It doesn't basically paint itself as this is the best way or this is the easiest way. This is a mostly adequate way to learn functional programming.
Have you found it to be mostly adequate?
Yes. Granted, I've only read 2 chapters and I had to stop. So what I've been doing is I've been trying to focus on other, like have less external distractions going on. I think we talked about that in a couple episodes ago. This morning, what I did was I just sat down at the table with some coffee and I started reading it. And whenever I saw something I didn't understand, I stopped reading and I started taking notes about it. And in this case, I didn't make it very far. One chapter. It wasn't even technically chapter one, I don't think. Maybe it was. But yeah, he started talking about math stuff and I'd never really heard anyone equate the things that I learned in high school or college maths to programming, and I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, I've actually been going through this ebook myself, and it really does a great job of breaking these concepts down and taking things that you probably already know or at least have some idea of and kind of reframing them to help you learn, which I like a lot.
Yeah, exactly. If we want to take a step back for a second, you know, I always heard people talk about functional programming, how great it was, and I'd always ask myself kind of silently, like, what I'm doing is working, you know, I'm building things that work. They're pretty okay. You know, there's not so many bugs. They're pretty performant. You know, why would I need to learn a new paradigm? You know, you always typically hear people say things like, oh, with functional programming, first of all, you don't have to deal with mutated state or your state changing in ways you didn't expect, because that can cause lots of bugs or lots of confusion, and it makes programs hard to trace through, essentially. And the second thing you end up hearing a lot is there are no side effects, and I never really understood what that meant. And then I also hear a lot of people talking about pure functions or pure JavaScript or whatever. And essentially what that means is you have a function that takes an input and it returns something, and it's only concerned with the input that it's given. It doesn't know about anything else. It doesn't care about anything else. It doesn't change anything else. So when people talk about having side effects in your code, they talk about when you run a function, it touches other things, and you might forget that's happening. And then so you run into a situation where you ask yourself a question like, when or how did that piece of state change? So a lot of people are pushing functional programming because you kind of get rid of those two problems in a way. You don't have side effects because you don't have state. It's just a pipeline. You have a pipeline of functions. You have data that goes in and then data that comes out the end. And that's basically it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I'm not writing stuff in a completely pure functional way just because that's not super conducive to the way that, or at least the stuff that I need to be writing right now. But what I have been trying to do is just write more functions that take some input, modify it, and give an output. And that's it. And what I've found has been a major help is it just makes testing so much easier. That's been huge. That's been the best part for me, is now I have this discrete unit of code where I know if I give it this thing, it should give me back this thing. And that just makes testing 10 times easier, at least for me. It's so much easier to wrap your head around what exactly needs to be tested and how.
Right. And it also makes it your program easier to reason about, right? So if I'm in Sublime or Atom or whatever, and I see a function, I don't know what it does, I can click go to definition and it's defined in that spot. And that's what it is, you know? It's not inheriting functionality from anything else. It's not pulling anything from anything else. It's just what it is right there, and I can see exactly what's happening. And that's been my most favorite thing so far, is that things become less shrouded in mystery. I think the biggest hurdle for me learning Rails was beyond learning the actual language Ruby, which wasn't that difficult. It was more so there's lots of shrouds of mystery, things that are just happening for you. Not that that's bad. It just made it more difficult for me to learn. So recently I've been picking up Elixir and Phoenix and what have you. And the thing I've noticed straight away from Phoenix, at least, is that all of the code that you see being used or imported, you can find that in the file directory. It's not abstracted away into a third-party package or anything like that. So it's been easier for me to actually get a good picture of what's happening behind the scenes.
Right. There's a lot less magic. Things are just kind of exposed for what they actually are.
Yeah, totally. And there are still lots of things about Elixir that confuse me, just because it's a new paradigm. And I'm trying really hard to not look around at all the, this is the best thing ever, and you should switch from X to Phoenix or Elixir. And I'm trying to learn Elixir just because it's a new thing. It's a new way of thinking and programming I've never had experience with, and I think it would be good for me. It just turns out that there happens to be, you know, a framework that's becoming more popular, or it's becoming really popular among startups and whoever else, I guess. Maybe it's just the people I follow on Twitter, but I'm trying to keep it really just learning Elixir for the sake of learning Elixir, not because I'm trying to replace X or Y tool in my toolkit.
Well, that's one of the great things about programming, is that when you learn something new, it doesn't have to be an all or nothing. You don't have to say, oh, I'm just an Elixir dev now. That's all I write. I've given up on Ruby. I've moved on. You can move concepts from both those languages kind of back and forth between each other and learn things in Elixir that you can take back to Ruby and help improve your code there.
Yeah, totally. And the book we're talking about, the Mostly I Quit Guide, is actually written with all the JavaScript examples. And so it's the concepts there, the functional programming concepts, are completely transferable to any language. In fact, he says right in the intro that we're using JavaScript, which isn't necessarily a functional language, but using a couple of libraries, it can be a totally fine functional programming language for you. So that's why I kind of picked it up, is because I'm interested in learning Elixir, and I have an Elixir book. I've been reading through it. I've been working through the Exorcism.io stuff. And my biggest setback right now is not Elixir the language, it's more Elixir the paradigm, not having any state. So in Elixir, when you define a variable, it's defined. And an interesting fact about Elixir is that a lot of people refer to it as an impure functioning or functional language, in the fact that in other functional language, when you define a variable A and then you try to redefine it later, you actually get an error saying you've already defined this, you can't override it. What Elixir does is it drops the first value and just reassigns it behind the scenes. So that's why people refer to it as impure. But the biggest setback for me is, how do I use a functional programming language where that happens? Because I'm so used to a class-based setup. And that's what kind of led me to this morning's just feeling of my brain, and I'm having to sift through it slowly. And that's why I dumped all these notes in our show notes. But the thing I thought most interesting were the math aspects. So it starts off with this example about seagulls, and you can either conjoin flocks, which would be addition, or you can breed flocks, which would be multiplication. So either the flocks are joining to become a bigger flock, or they're multiplying through breeding and becoming much larger. And he sets up a basic object-oriented approach where you have your base JavaScript object and then you prototype methods onto it. And at the bottom, you have a pretty complicated chain of functions that are breeding and conjoining, and it's hard to follow. And this, he goes through iterations on this. So the second iteration, he starts to pull out some of the really complicated setup down below, and he renames conjoin and breed to add and multiply. And just by renaming conjoin and breed to add and multiply, it made so much more sense in my mind. And the third iteration, he actually takes the really complicated portion at the bottom. And this is what I thought was most interesting. So actually in his example, the last line would be something like flock underscore a dot conjoin, flock underscore c dot breed, flock underscore b dot conjoin. And you can see what I'm getting at. It's just kind of hard to follow. And he renames them to add and multiply, which in my mind instantly makes it a little bit easier to follow because those are more familiar concepts to me. And then what he does is he uses these different properties that are available in just the math world. And I remember learning about them. And so he has this example annotated where he takes a really long line and says, this is the original line. And then the second line is he applies something like the identity property to remove an extra function call. And then below that, he applies the distributive property to slim it down even farther than that. And that's what I thought was so interesting, was that he was using these ideas, the associative property, the identity property, distributive property. And I'll have a link to all this stuff in show notes. But he actually uses these properties to simplify all these function calls down into something that's pretty readable.
I feel like what's really interesting about that to me is for quite a while in web programming especially, there was such a focus on, oh, you know, we don't need math. Math doesn't really matter. You can program without being good at math. And I feel like we've kind of hit a turning point where people are realizing, oh, actually, some basic math concepts do make a lot of this so much simpler. So maybe we should think about math more.
Yeah, totally. And the funny thing was, when I first read it, I was like, whoa, it was like too much for me to handle almost. And so what I did was I just stopped reading and I started taking notes. And I mentioned the associative property, and essentially what that is, I guess the definition is the associative property states that you can add or multiply regardless of how the numbers are grouped. So you're essentially thinking about parentheses and order of operations, right? A times B would be the same as B times A, right? And so essentially what he did was he took this property, this way of thinking, knowing that you can reverse a multiplication, the order of how that happens, and it'll come out the same. And so what he did was he simplified the end function call. He flipped those around and suddenly it made so much more sense. So we applied this pretty simple rule to how he was structuring his program, and it made it cleaner and easier to maintain. And it's not that he was doing any sort of complicated math, you know. He was using this idea that you can do this with certain numbers. And multiplication in parentheses is pretty similar how you'd use functions, right? I mean, you have parentheses that kick off the multiplication and those take arguments in a function. And so, I don't know, it just clicked. And I've never thought about programming in that way before.
A lot of this stuff, as I've been going through the Mostly Adequate guide, reminds me a lot of things that I've kind of picked up through doing stuff with processing and other like just kind of visualization things or any graphics stuff. You just kind of get this hammered into you really quick by doing that. So if you're getting into FP or, you know, wanting to learn about all these things, picking up some processing or any kind of like games programming or something where there's an event loop basically and you're mutating stuff over time, you'll learn a lot of these little tricks, I think, naturally on working with numbers and just kind of thinking about things more in this way.
Well, I think that's a great idea, because with something like processing, you can have a pretty instant feedback. So you can actually see results of what's happening. Whereas in Elixir, if you're working in the Elixir, the interactive Elixir REPL, you know, you're typing stuff and then you see a line get evaluated and that's it. Whereas processing, you have more of an interactive experience in seeing directly what's happening as you change the data.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, these days there's even p5.js out now. So you don't even have to learn a separate syntax. You don't have to learn the processing language itself, but the entire API is still available and you can also use web technologies on top of it. So that's a really easy way for web programmers to kind of break into this kind of thing.
And if I'm not mistaken, you were messing around with processing maybe a couple of months ago, right?
Yeah, I've been starting to do some music visualization stuff. I'm working with some bands in town and building those things out. So it was just something that I've wanted to do for a long time, and I've finally been hopping in. And it's kind of surprising how the underlying philosophies of something like processing, which uses so many globals all over the place all the time, and something that's very clean, like Elixir, very clean, very functional. It's amazing how many similarities there still are between those two in how you think about numbers and transforming things and all that. It's just one more example of how portable all this programming knowledge really is, I think.
Well, the part that actually stuck out to me when you told me that was you said it was the coolest thing you've ever made, which I thought was awesome, which means, I mean, you clearly enjoyed making it. And I think that's the point, right? You had fun doing it. You made something that you're proud of.
Yeah, for me, doing visualization stuff lately has just been, it's neat to actually do something that is more in the art space, I guess, but still uses all those same programming muscles that I've been building up.
That's really cool. It's kind of like when you have a skill, or maybe you're learning how to play guitar and you play your first show and you're like, wow, I mean, all those years of work actually led to something that brought me joy and possibly other people as well.
All right. So it's been a bit since we've done this, but we just had a couple smaller cool things that we wanted to talk about a bit. The first one is CertBot. I'm actually using CertBot now on a live project, and it is the best thing. It is just so easy to set up. They've done an incredible job. I think it took probably about 5 minutes on a brand new server, having not actually deployed with CertBot before, to have it up, auto-renewing and installing the certs, and SSL live in production on the site. It was just, it's such a pleasant experience. And if you haven't looked at CertBot yet, you should definitely take a look at it.
Now, I can verify this information because I recently used CertBot on my website, and I had talked about it so much, and I never actually used it, but I did, and it just pulled through. It was so nice to use. Like Paul said, 5 minutes and it was set up. I didn't even need to tell it if I'm using Nginx or Apache. It just knew what was going on, and it worked.
Yep. It's like a curl, and then you run the certbot auto command, and then you're pretty much done.
The only extra stuff that I had to do was actually enable the SSL module for Apache. And then I had to, if I remember correctly, I had to enable the default config settings for an SSL website. But those were just one-off commands for Apache anyway. So even then, it wasn't difficult.
So what did you end up using CertBot for?
I just turned HTTPS on my personal website.
I love it.
I don't know. I just like the green lock, and it makes me feel more legitimate. So that's what I did.
That's awesome. I had to set it up because I was doing an e-commerce thing. I'm selling hats now. Love a link to them in the show notes. They're pretty cool. You should check them out. Alrighty. Second thing we wanted to talk about. We've mentioned this before. I know we've talked about Facebook Instant Articles a bit on the show, and AMP as well. But we just figured we'd chat a little bit more about AMP because it's pretty interesting, I think. And it's going to be very transformative for the internet over the next couple of years. At least ideas like this.
Yeah, it's very similar to something like Facebook Instant Articles in the sense that they kind of latch on to your content and they make it look nice. And more importantly, they make it really fast.
It's so incredibly fast. And for me, one of the big downsides of this, and one of the things that I find concerning is a bit too strong of a word, but concerning, is just that a lot of stuff that is AMP looks very, very, very similar to each other. There's not much room for customization and personalization, which is good in the sense that it's super usable and very fast. But I do kind of worry about everything looking the same.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of my first impression of it as well. I remember just looking at it one morning. I think someone tweeted about it, and so I was watching a video about it one morning, and I tried it out, and everything looked really similar, and I think the only thing that stood out were maybe like a couple of colors and maybe a brand or two, and it reminded me a lot of the Apple News app, and so the Apple News app does a little bit to distinguish between, you know, Huffington Post or CNN or something like that, but, you know, the content kind of bleeds together, or the publications kind of bleed together, so you end up getting just a wall of content, and again, it's kind of hard for me to tell as a normal consumer because I make websites and design websites and stuff, but it's hard for me to tell, you know, does that make things easier for people? Obviously, it makes things faster. You know, you maybe viewing an article from The Verge on AMP, it's going to be so much faster than viewing it on The Verge's site, you know, because they have so much extra JavaScript going on. But I feel like I'm kind of torn because I do like going to different sites and seeing just the differences in design and differences in how content is displayed. But the biggest thing for me, and probably for most consumers, is just going to be pure speed.
I think there are a couple really cool and interesting things about AMP. One of them, this is such a tiny little thing, but I just love the little lightning bolt emoji in the HTML tag. It makes me very happy. And I think that's a great way to signify an AMP page. So for anybody who doesn't have any idea what I'm talking about there, if you go to the AMP website, which we'll have a link to in the show notes, and you check out their kind of getting started page, you'll see this. The HTML tag actually has a little lightning bolt immediately after it in AMP pages, which is just really funny and awesome. It's just kind of one of those nice little touches that makes it a pleasure to work with, right?
It's funny because you, when you said that, I pulled the page up just to see for myself, and it's literally just the emoji, just a lightning emoji in the HTML tag.
Yeah. The first time I saw that, it threw me off a little bit. I was like, wait, am I? No, but there's actually just an emoji there, which is pretty cool. So, goofy little thing, but kind of fun anyway.
And it seems like you're able to have some stylistic control over a style tag with an AMP boilerplate attribute added to it.
Yeah, I think you're limited to something or other. This is something I need to look into more. I'm thinking about actually switching my site, my personal site, over to an AMP-based page. So maybe I'll do that, and then we can kind of chat about it a bit more on a future episode.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool. I'd be willing to try that. I've been finally blogging more than I'd the previous year combined. So earlier you were mentioning to me this Google AMP cache and how you thought that it was going to be pretty cool. Do you want to talk more about that?
Yeah, I think that's probably the most interesting part of AMP for me is, so Google's actually providing the service, which they just call the Google AMP cache. It is actually a CDN that at least says it's going to deliver all valid AMP documents. It fetches AMP HTML pages and then caches them and runs some performance optimizations on their side. So what it's actually doing is taking the document itself and all the JavaScript files and images they load from the Google origin over HTTP2. And this is just something Google is providing for all AMP pages on the entire internet, apparently. That's a very different way of thinking about the internet. And it'll be very interesting to see how that kind of shapes things over the next couple of years.
So essentially, you can modify at least an endpoint of your website to return AMP valid HTML, and then they'll say, we're going to cache this and put it on a CDN for you.
That is the case, yeah. That's what they're saying.
Huh.
It's just kind of amazing that Google, as a company, can build something out of that scale to say, okay, any AMP page on the internet is now something we're going to be serving out of our own CDN.
It's funny that when we talk about this, the first thing in the back of my mind is, when is the first email going to arrive in my inbox asking me to implement a feature for a client? So my main client right now actually does a lot of publications and a lot of writing, and they've already asked me about integrating with Facebook Instant Articles, or at least having some sort of pushed to where they, when they author content in the CMS I built, it pushes it to Instant Articles. They've asked me about Medium as well, because now that Medium has an API where you can publish to. And now I'm waiting for the email to roll in with Google AMP documents.
Well, fortunately, based on what I've seen, it should at least be pretty straightforward. Seems like they've done a great job with this. I know Ilya Grigorik has had some input on it, and he's pretty well known for making good decisions around performance stuff. So,
well, that's really good to hear. And I mean, the good thing is too that even with the Medium API or the Facebook API, they're not bad to work with. You know, it's just something to consider, and it's just another fun challenge to consider. Obviously, I want my clients to have the best experience possible, and I want their audience to have the best experience possible. So, you know, if using tools like this makes getting content to them easier and faster and more performant, then I'm all on board.
Alrighty. So the final thing we wanted to talk about today is js.org. So they own that TLD. They own js.org. And what they've done with it is they're allowing anybody to set up subdomains under it. So you can have your project name .js.org or like your screen name .js.org. And just kind of get a really nice domain for your site. So if you have an open source project, instead of having, you know, just the GitHub pages URL, you can point it to projectname.js.org. And that's just kind of a really neat thing. I think that's a great, great service.
I like the intro paragraph on this, actually. It just says, two decades after the domain js.org was registered for the first time, it finally serves its obvious purpose. I think that's really cool. Just the point that they, just the fact that they point out they've been around, you know, this domain's been around for 20 years. Feels like a piece of history.
So I'm not going to spoil anything here, but I do think listeners should go to archive.org. We'll have a link to this in show notes and browse through some of the very early versions of JS.org. It's had an interesting history, it seems. Apparently, it was the Jerusalem School of Synoptic Research.
Yeah, JerusalemPerspective.com. What?
Thanks again to Hired for sponsoring this episode of Does Not Compute. Designers and developers looking for new jobs should definitely give them a try. One of the really neat things about Hired is that they hide your profile from current and past employers, so there are no privacy concerns. If you sign up at hired.com/doesnotcompute and find your next job through Hired, they'll give you a $2,000 thank you bonus. So you'll get $2,000, a new job, and help support the show all at once. Take a look at hired.com/doesnotcompute. If you have any questions or thoughts about the show, feel free to say hi. We're on Twitter at DNCcast, and Sean and I both love chatting with folks in the Spec Slack. You can sign up right now at spec.fm/slack. Essentially, what they've done is they have the www.js.org website. They own that domain. Wow, I said www.
On the World Wide Web. The World Wide Web.